you piqued me when you were like, have you seen the Welcome Festival? Who are they welcoming? Is this like a big tent? Is that like
They're
alluding
welcoming
to
big donors,
they're welcoming Matt Iglesias?
presumably. I mean, he's speaking there, so.
Yeah, these are from my notes, right? The one thing, I mean, it's so ridiculous because everybody's sort of saying the same thing. The one thing the abundance people don't take into account is like the profit motive, the capitalist motive to do stuff. It's always like, well, the environmentalist won't let us do X, Y, and Z, or zoning won't let us do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
As if that has anything to do with it. Like, sure. But when you want to get around it, you get around it. Like it's a profit motive. Like, and nothing made it more clear to me than going to that homelessness task force meeting yesterday.
Yeah.
So, because it's just like, well, let's get into it. In the Shadow Rocker Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast. I'm Rob, this is the Highlands Bunker Podcast. Hello. First thing is, every once in a while I gotta tell everyone, you know, you can hit us up at patreon.com/thehighlandsbunker. Help us out, $5, $10 a month. Help the cause a little bit. I think we've been doing good stuff. Everybody seems to be enjoying it. I also know that when people start hitting me up like, hey, you said Frank's going to be on. When's Frank going to be on? Like that I know people are listening and like hanging on to every episode, which I do like and appreciate. So kick in, help us out. Because I can also tell you Frank will be in next week. We've rescheduled Frank Burns. Lots of great questions for him. You know, did he get teased? Like I got teased for his name, like the MASH thing. Did he get that? Because I always have sort of like this simpatico relationship with people who have names that they can get to sort of a play on words with, obviously. We'll talk about the Pope. That'll be fun. But yeah, that's coming next week, so get ready. But for this week, we're going to just talk about some news items with Super Producer Carl. So, Carl, hello.
Hello, how's it going?
It's going okay. So, yeah, I go to this homelessness task force meeting.
This is the city of Wilmington.
The city of Wilmington Homelessness Task Force.
Yeah.
Right. So, number one, I got to go into the building, and I've always wanted to go in because there's basically a train station building that's now behind the train station at like French Street and the river.
Is this the CSC building?
The CSC.
Oh,
building.
Yeah, yeah, I've been.
So the thing is, like, it's neat. I wanted.
It's a nice building.
I've always wanted to go in there. I got to do that, but then you're just like CSC. Like.
Yeah, I mean it's a classic Delaware gentry, or not even Delaware. This is any Rust Belt town that has those like brick, beautiful, old fashioned, like early 1900s brick buildings that they kind of gut out and they fill it with the very like early 2010s tech startup vibe.
That's exactly it.
Yeah,
I mean CSC.
Which is nice. It's not bad.
First of all,
CSC. Stuff in there.
It's yeah, nice. It is neat. I mean CSC obviously is just like there's nothing. I love like telling people what that means when they don't know. Like my buddy Andre has a friend who works in like HR there, and I was like, "Do you know what it means?" I was like, "It's Corporation Service Center. It's
yeah.
our score, whatever.
Or
it's
council,
like council or whatever.
Corporation.
It's just
I
yeah,
think it
I
might
mean,
be."
And it's the people that help the people that we're like, you know, it's like, how do you get a registered agent? How do you work through the paperwork? It's just
corporation service company.
Yeah, yeah.
The most like anonymous sounding, like evil corporation.
Classic, people. Classic. So I go up to the fourth floor, and it was exactly like you're saying. Like it's just this like they have the old oak panels on the floor. They still have the steel beams. It looks really dope. But it's like. It just reminds you of like what's the place in the Nemours building? There's like a communal workspace.
Oh, the mill.
The mill. It looks like yeah, it's like that. I just always think about WeWork too.
Yes, I mean it's but yeah, it's like local WeWork.
Yeah, But yeah, the furniture's cool. They have a real like cool huge conference room at the end of the building, and that's where the meeting was.
Yep.
It was good to see the Spotlight Delaware's own Nick Stonecipher, reporter extraordinaire. So that was good. So I saw him setting up, and he was funny. He was like, oh, do you need an outlet or anything? And I'm like, nah, just chill at these. I was like, now that I know you're here covering this, I can cover what you do. You know, so that was cool. But yeah, it really is sobering. That's the word I'll use. When you go in there and you see, you know, all the business owners, and nothing against like the carpet people, the mom and pop, because it's like a man and his wife to own the carpet thing that's over by Christina Park. But it's mostly like just nonprofit executives, Claire DeMatteis and her people from the city. And you can really tell, it was the first time I really like been in a room with Claire DeMatteis, who I despise maybe more than Carney. But you can see why people like that are successful, because if you come from a corporate environment like I come from, you can notice people that are like, they know how to go through the paces. Everybody's prepped to say the thing they're going to say. Everybody's ready to do the thing.
Yeah, it's all scripted out ahead of time.
Yeah, like...
maybe not literally, but...
correct. I mean, they stick to the agenda. They run the meeting. You know, they have... They need to get this information out, and that's what they do. So from a professionalism standpoint, they pull... I mean, obviously, they know how to do that. So that's what they did. I can't remember the name of the company that... gave basically, it was a 2-hour meeting. I had to leave after about an hour 20, and they were just finishing the agenda items. There was some public comment, so activists did speak, and there was a little bit of a commotion, we'll say, but we'll get to that in due course. The name of the nonprofit is Springboard. Now, these are the people who did, like, the pallet or tiny home community in Georgetown. And so they were explaining what that consists of, how it works. But really what they were doing was talking about how they're able to acquire the funds to do it. Now you realize why all these people are in the room, why Declarative Maddie says the world, why you're like, you know, you feel like you're in an executive board meeting. But you're talking about homelessness. Well, the big thing is, how do we get the money? So they talk a lot about that, how they got the funds for Georgetown, how they could get reoccurring funds. But it was all like, well, we can get it through federal funds. There is money there to not only fund us, but fund, you know, the services that we have come in to these villages, I guess they call them, mm-hmm. which is, I don't like that word. Again, on one hand, as he's describing this thing with these cabins, basically prefabbed cabins for one person, they actually will take couples. There's also food there. There's toilets and bathroom cleanup. They have offices for other services, so all the other kinds of services that people would need would have an office there. And the other thing is they don't have a lot of, like, restrictions. Like, they don't test for drugs. Like, if you go out and do drugs and come back, you live your life, you know. There's no, you can come and go as you please kind of thing, which I know not a lot of places are like that. But as he's talking, I wrote in my notes, all this is very, very suspicious. And the other thing that they said was, well, we can get around zoning because we can basically call it a temporary emergency. So what we need to do is, our project falls under this sort of temporary emergency statute that already exists, and then we have more flexibility about the stuff that we can do.
Okay.
And then somebody said, well, how long are people there? Like, you're asking for the state to get a long-term contract to cover, like, 10 years. And he's like, well, it's like a gray area. Like, we don't want to be there the whole time, but we'll be there long enough to get people through. So I think they've been open in, like, Georgetown for 2 years or something like that.
Yeah, sounds about right.
And they said there have been a few people that are, you know, just are there and they've been there 2 years. He said most of the people, it's like, it's actually the numbers coming down are there for between 3 and 5 months, something like that.
Okay.
That's like the average. But back to the abundance thing and why this really, really rubbed me the wrong way. Because the guy who's giving the presentation is talking about, like, we're housing first, we figure housing solves these problems, and, you know, it's just we have to catch up. We can't build housing fast enough, so we need an interim step to get the housing build up and figure out all of these other issues. And he said that as an answer to a question. He said it as part of his presentation. He said some version of that 2 or 3 times. Now, I'm sitting on French Street behind the train station, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking within 7 or 8 blocks of here, we've built more housing in the last 10 years or 15 years than I would have thought that they would have built in Wilmington in my life. We got, you know, the Humble Park.
We got the press.
We got the two buildings on Shipley that went up that ran out Creative Visions Factory.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch on like King Street.
And there's one across the street from the Chase Building, like right next to the bus station. There's one there on Market. Yeah. Like, you know, the one I'm talking about. It faces the Chase Building, kind of the back of the hall. It has a name.
Yeah, they all have names.
Yeah, they all. You have to have a name. I mean, you have to have. You know, I think there's one that's called like something Hill. So he's talking about somehow we're not able to build housing. That's a lie. We can build housing. We can build housing if there's money in it. And this is what abundance will never, this is why abundance is dead on arrival, failure. Anybody who's listening to this, who's entertaining the abundance agenda, stop doing that immediately. It's all fucking fake. Because again, it's not, we can do it. It's just we choose the way we do it. We don't want to solve social problems. We want to make sure that somebody's making money. And that's it. You know, to say that we need this temporary fix because we can't build housing fast enough, that's just not true. Especially sitting where I was sitting and looking out, you know, over the riverfront, which is a whole neighborhood that didn't even exist when I was a kid. And then 5, 6 new towers in basically West Center City adjacent places. And turning, I guess, some of the old Hercules building into residences too, high end, because the companies aren't coming back. It's a huge building on the Brandywine River, the other end of downtown. So, like, don't fucking tell me that it takes a long time. You just don't want to do it. You know, you have to come up with some. It takes a long time to come up with the scheme by which you're going to do it, where you know it kind of has to, you know, you're just going to do as little as you possibly can. And it really pissed me off.
Yeah, I do want to spend a little bit more time talking, not too much talking about abundance, because
of everybody's what I just said.
Talking about it. And I don't want to talk too much about, like, it's become,
there's abundantly too much talk about abundance.
Yeah, it's designed to drive discourse, which I don't like to fall into too much, but like my understanding of what their response to that would be is, yes, it is difficult to build housing, so that the only housing we can build is this high-end stuff that we know is going to turn a profit because it's only like higher income people doing it. And what we need to do is build so much housing everywhere that rents are forced to come down because there's just too much competition between the different new apartments. That
and the incentive to do that is what? Lowering standards and...
Lowering standards, so... Zoning, and that's where it gets into the different stuff. Because there are some things that I think everybody basically agrees, like, even on the left, are, like, necessary, which is, you know, inclusive zoning, you know, increasing the amount of money going into low-income housing development. So if you talk to, like, Russ Huxtable, he's like, what we need to do is, like, add more money into these, like, financial incentives so that there's going to be more of a financial gain for people to build affordable housing specifically. And then if you go to people on the left, it's the same thing. I think really at this point in Delaware as well, like even if you talk to folks on the Homes campaign, everybody's kind of on board with like the concept of building more housing. And there's like a few things that have already been done, a few things that are probably going to be done in the upcoming years to do that. But, and like, you know, for example, if you look at like the flats over off of Union Street, very new, nice development. I think generally pretty affordable, all things considered. I don't know.
Yeah, I had a conversation with Chris Willauer before she was councilperson Willauer about that because I'm from that neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, my mom grew up in Little Italy and everything. And what I took away from that conversation about the flats was that it was a successful project.
Yeah.
Like they took basically substandard housing and replaced it with brand new housing, basically unit for unit.
Yeah.
No loss. So, and again, it's just like almost, I don't know if it was a break even, but it wasn't like more, it wasn't more housing, but it took the bad stock and made it basically brand new.
Yep. And it's just like a really nice neighborhood now. Like I've walked out because it's right on Bancroft Parkway. It's a really nice
area. It's only a block. I mean, part of it is basically on Union Street. So there's a high street there where there are shops and restaurants and stuff like that. It's nice.
Yeah. And there's also, I know they're like redeveloping Riverside, which I'm not following that super closely because I don't spend as much time around there, but it's, you know, there's some processes to replace substandard housing with like better housing that is still somewhat affordable. And so, you know, I don't want to like completely discount those efforts, but it really does get to, and I want to talk about Welcome Fest specifically. Because I haven't seen stuff about this all day and I'm having a blast. Because there's, I have not read the full Abundance book, but I've read enough to sort of understand the basic idea, which is just generally over the last 50 years, the development of like liberalism is the specific word used, but like the left is sort of the broader implication, is basically they've made it harder to do everything. So whether that's building new power, whether that's building housing, whether that is even just having functional bureaucracy.
High-speed rail in California.
Like, regulations and stuff added on to all this process. And it's not just regulations. There's, like, democratic efforts, this and that, that have made it more difficult to build things. And that is both in the private sector and in the public sector. And the idea of abundance is we need to streamline these systems. Some of that is taking off regulations. Some of that is just, like, combining things together. It really depends on the individual like thing, and that'll allow us to build more housing, build more energy, build more rail, build more this, have better functioning government, all that stuff. And on its face, I basically agree with that. And I think most people, if you talked about that in a broad concept, would basically agree with that. But what has happened now, and I think was probably pretty intentional even from the start, was it has been grafted onto the group of centrist Democrats who are trying to turn it into like their motto for their shitty movement. And it's like a bunch of people who are funded by these corporate think tanks who get made fun of by leftists on Twitter and Blue Sky that cannot get over it and are trying to use this as a cudgel more than anything. And so that like is coming out, especially in this Welcome Fest thing, which is happening right now. We're recording this on Wednesday. It's happening in Washington, D.C., I believe.
Yeah.
And you get so many greats. You got Matt Iglesias. You get Adam Gentleson. You got Representative Tom Suozzi.
I don't know who that is.
Richie Torres.
Oh, he's that guy's a legend.
Josh Barrow.
God.
Who's the Jake Auchincloss, guy who used to be a Republican? And just so many people whose identity is being reasonable, but never seem to have really talked to a normal person in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this before, and I've used the term like technocrat. Like, if we just apply, if we can take away like the regulation and the stuff that's holding us back, and we can apply some math and figure out, you know, get AI in there to figure out how to do this, it'll work. It won't work. The worst thing is that it always comes back to, because the one thing I saw about it today was at one of the talks, somebody was being interviewed and was like, yeah, you know, when you look into this regulation or what is hindering development, what's hindering the production of homes, infrastructure, all that. you go back, and it goes back to the labor unions.
Yep.
And I'm
yep.
like, does it though? Does it? Are you kind of giving the game away now? It's like the labor unions and environmental activists that somehow have the smallest possible power sources, if any, in this country. Somehow they're dictating the regulations that are making it impossible to do anything.
Yeah.
I don't buy it on its face.
And it's so obvious that apart from the idea of abundance, which we talked about, like there's parts of it that are fine, whatever. But it's so when you look at the people who are pushing for it, whether it's Matt Iglesias, Richie Torres, people like that. And you have Matt Iglesias, and when they were talking about stuff, politics a year or two ago, what were they talking about? They're talking about popularism. Remember popularism? Which is, we should do things that are popular. Which, like, sure, okay, whatever. But as always, it's just like, oh, we got to become economically more moderate and we got to become socially more moderate. And now they're pushing abundance as, like, their sort of motto. And how is Matt Iglesias talking about this? He's talking about the Democrats' main electoral issues being school closures during COVID, paralysis on women's sports, and candidates running on late-term abortions.
Nobody's doing that.
It's just the same fucking thing that, like, they were complaining about in the 90s. And then also, they did a poll of, like, abundance messages versus, like, left populist messages. And the left populist ones were, of course, more popular. And all those people who were, like, on the popularism train a few months ago, basically, before Biden, like, dropped out, they then all were like, well, no, it's not about being popular. It's about having good policy. It's like, okay, so you're just dropping the old stuff so you can get the new stuff. Whatever, like, crypto billionaire is funneling money into whatever fucking organization you're a part of, you're just going to toe the company line. And, like, people on the left do that, too.
It's all very corporate.
We don't hold ourselves as, like, high and mighty as, like, oh, we're the reasonable ones.
Yeah. And the other thing is that it is all very corporate, and it's very nakedly corporate. It's like, okay, so you got your ass beat in another election. Nobody likes what you're selling. So let's just brand it differently. Like, nobody likes what you're fucking selling. Like, that's the problem. Like, on the right, reactionaries will get further reactionary and come up with popular things that people want to hear, whether they're right, wrong, whether they're authoritarian or, you know, neo-fascist or whatever they are. They just do that. But Democrats just cannot make any concessions. They cannot say, yeah, you know what? Medicare for all probably would have been a pretty good thing to do, or whatever it is. They have to come up with some kind of cockamamie, like, brand that nobody, you know, and they have to write this book that, like, is kind of, like, vague on, they're like, oh, they built more homes in Texas. Yeah, well, look at Austin and Houston housing prices. Have they gone down? No, they haven't, actually. So, yes, they did, you know, per capita or whatever, were able to build more homes in Texas than California. Okay.
And also, Houston, I think Austin, the rents have either leveled out or gone down, or at least that's the
data.
Well,
my thing was,
give.
I think.
Houston is your other example, and the reason why certain things like regulations exist, which is my family's from Houston.
Yeah.
That's why I'm an Astros fan.
I don't know why I had to.
That's why I have to justify it.
God damn it.
And yeah, Houston is sort of notorious for it's probably the largest city that basically doesn't have zoning laws. Because obviously, like, New York, Philly, L.A., they all have, like, some. Houston being in Texas and being, like, a fairly spread out area, they don't really have zoning laws, so you can do basically whatever you want when it comes to, like, building shit in Houston. But the issue is Houston is also a swamp on the edge of on the Gulf of Mexico, and it keeps getting hit by hurricanes. I don't know if you've heard about this.
Are there hurricane seasons? I don't know.
And because there's no regulation and they're paving over, like, endless amount of wetlands, every time a hurricane or even just, like, a particularly large rainstorm goes over Houston, it's underwater for, like, a week. And actually, this happened actually with my grandmother's house before she passed away. It was not in Houston. It was north in Conroe. And there was, like, a development. It wasn't done super well. And because they didn't do the proper, like, preparation for this development, all of the water in the whole development flowed through one place, and that one place happened to be her house.
So your grandmom got an abundance of water.
She got an abundance of water.
She was flooded out by abundance. Yeah.
She was not able to walk up and downstairs. They had to move because they kept having to live on the second floor because there's feet of water on the first floor because they did not plan this thing correctly. Yeah. Like,
well, that point was made too in Texas is like because of the sprawl.
Yeah.
You can go out further and further out and pave it over.
Yeah.
You could do that.
You could do that. It's not really a great
idea. Yeah. You know. And yeah.
And that's like those are the reasons why these regulations are put in place. I saw another thing from the abundance book, which is like, well, if we have to choose between not building housing and building housing that doesn't have like air filtration systems next to a freeway, who are we to say we shouldn't build that housing anyways? And it's like, well, people are gonna fucking die. So it's this thing of basically not being willing. And I understand like they're now trying to shift the Overton window, I guess, back to the right. So like good for you. But it's this unwillingness to, ironically, to look at these things on their merits. Like I agree that there's certain regulations and processes that are probably burdensome and like not necessarily great, but just by being like, oh, well, we got to get rid of all that stuff because like we need to grow at all costs. Once again, that's just the profit motive. That's just like coming back to the logic of infinite growth, which is obviously not, we've seen it. It's not sustainable.
Yeah. I mean, that's the economic, the idea of capital and profit taking and rent seeking and the idea that there is a political aspect to this, they kind of like glaze over. It's like,
yeah, it's anti-politics.
It's all it is we get yelled at by the left. And so we're going to come up with a brand that kind of shuts them out or is like, or actually they're actually, the left is actually the villain here. And so the stuff that they did actually isn't why there's enough housing for people. Now, because I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that. That is pretty clearly what they're saying.
Yeah.
Is that the obstacles to growth and infrastructure, housing, whatever, utilities, energy is a big one, have been the people who have been making fun of me, like you said. They're actually the ones that are and they're the ones that are fucking all of this up. See, a Republican wouldn't do that.
Yeah, and that's when you're talking. If you were to talk to like Ezra Klein about it, he would probably have a more nuanced, like, oh yeah, of course that. Yeah, but that's the thing, and that's the reason why it's been so frustrating, which is it's gotten so clearly grafted onto reactionary centrism that has been looking for a thing to pick up, and in 2 years they're gonna have a new thing.
Yeah.
It's just that they've been trying to do the DLC over and over and over again since the 80s. Really since the 70s.
Yeah. Well,
as soon as like the AFL got kicked out of the party officially, which, yeah, you know, you could argue needed to be done given what they were doing in 1968. But, you know, it left a very wide gap that a lot of weird stuff is filled in.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just this, it's an ideology of reactionary centrism, of like, we cannot let it get, but it's already the cat, the horse is out of the barn. Like, we're too far down the road now. We have to start making, you know, big decisions on big stuff to get people, to get working people, poor people, disenfranchised people, get them solid, because we're going down Schitt's Creek, and it's over. Like, the idea that we're gonna technocrat our way out of it, if you just let AI and the technocrats at it, they'll sort it right out. Like, that they're not going to. They didn't 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago when they came up with the idea, 40 years ago. It hasn't worked. And the thing I keep thinking about is the thing we keep talking about, because it was like the theme of the Sarah McBride interview, was like, okay, this is the political situation we're in the country. Do you think Democrats have learned their lesson? And my theory was that they didn't. And her theory was that they could, or she was. And I think so far, I look like I'm right. Or at least abundance would suggest that I'm right. Because this is clearly an attempt to rebrand, you know, to rebrand a corporate neoliberal centrist reaction. That's it.
Yep.
So, okay, that's enough of abundance. Enough. I do have to finish the story about the the
yeah, we were doing that for
task force.
Cut that out.
No, that's fine. We'll leave it in. Who cares? But the task force, near the end of the presentation of the first big presentation about the homes, somebody spoke up in the back. Kind of, it was question and answer, but this was more like, I'm just going to yell at you. And it was a homeless woman who some of the activist people there knew. And she said, well, what if we don't want to go to this village, this camp, whatever? And he said, well, you don't have to. We're not, you know, just, there's no like forcible thing. This is just for people who want to go. We will work with you, et cetera, et cetera. And basically had the corporate response. It didn't go well because it was like she finally said, I actually at this point just want to be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was pretty profound. And then she got upset. She stepped out. And I think a couple friends or some activists went to step out with her. And I thought to myself, like, the thing that there isn't ever going to be, and there certainly isn't going to be on this task force, considering Claire DeMatteis is the head of it, and, you know, the cops are on it, and, you know, the Sunday breakfast mission's on it, and all that stuff. But there's never even a bit of sort of empathy or understanding about why someone rough sleeping, living in a tent in Christina Park, would not trust you. You being, you know, the state apparatus,
yeah,
the government, whatever. The people in suits that are saying what they're going to do with you. You know, how they're going to handle you. And so nobody, with a cop in the room. So nobody ever says, you know, ma'am, still say the same thing you said. But just show a little bit of understanding and say, you know what? I do sort of understand. I understand why this, you know, us standing here talking about what we're going to do with you or what we think we're going to do or, you know, experiences you've had, like why you wouldn't trust us, why you feel this way. And I'm sorry. You know, I'm glad your voice is here. And that's it. It's like, just say something, show a little bit of fucking compassion. But it's like being in an executive meeting at a bank that I was in, talking about like next quarter's, you know, pilot pricing program, having somebody who we bankrupted yell and just get escorted out of the room and pretend like it didn't happen. You know, we didn't have to deal with that, but it was just a weird, really surreal moment. Go ahead.
Yeah, because I think when it comes to homelessness, it's very similar really to any situation where you're managing like an excess population, for lack of a better word. Like if you're talking about the prison population, if you're talking about undocumented immigrants, if you're talking about basically the people who have been shunted to the side of society because they're a problem and we just kind of have to have them there.
Around here, they're very,
fully
very
Marxist
low,
about it,
they're
if
very
you want,
low wage labor.
Low wage, yeah. Anybody who
you can
is,
cheat
you can just kind of push
same,
them around.
Same with
them
prisoners, right?
You
can pay them 5 cents a day or whatever. You can have them come clean,
yep,
Delaware state offices. Well, I've seen them do that.
Yep.
I've seen them do printing for the thing. Yeah, so there's still, that's like a slavery.
Yeah, and so in that case, essentially, even if obviously they're people, but they're not really people in the sense that they're not seen as a constituency that has agency and really should be consulted and have its say in the political process. So whether it's someone experiencing homelessness, whether it's a prisoner, whether it's a super low wage labor, it's children, honestly, to a certain extent, like it's people who are just not consulted in their own lives.
Yeah.
And that becomes really clear when they have to be managed. Because you can see there's a person right in front of you. They have a face, they have a body, they have
a
brain.
We're all listening.
We can understand what they're saying.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, the same way that a conquistador would have seen a Aztec, like just like, oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah,
like, oh, I'm gonna go take their stuff now.
Yeah, it was I guess it was weird to me because I struggle in those rooms. I get very anxious for a bunch of different reasons. Number one is because I there's a lot of these people I don't like. I have like corporate world flashbacks. I literally sent the, we're all sitting there and a few of us were messaging each other as we were sitting there as the room was filling up. There was a lot of people there for a 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday or 4 o'clock, yeah, whatever. There was 50 people probably there, maybe. So I was already uncomfortable. I sent the meme out of Jose Mourinho saying, I prefer not to speak.
Yeah.
I could speak, but if I did, I would be in big trouble, and I don't want to be in big trouble. So I just sent that meme. I never said a word. But as the woman went out, another thing started, and it was about this ordinance they're going to pass to make like a drug-free zone around, like, you know, whatever. Again, this is a new pressure. So yeah, watch out for that, because they're going to try to figure out a way to put something in the city code so that these people can be managed by armed people in more of an aggressive way, if you get my drift. Because that's all this is. They'll say, well, Claire DeMatteis will say something like, well, drugs are illegal anyway, and we already have these rules around churches and schools. Well, yeah, that's the same reason you have them around churches and schools. It's just to be able to...
Yeah, because then everywhere in the city also...
Yeah, of course, it just covers everywhere. And then you're like, actually, we can hit you with another year because you did it in a drug-free school zone.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all bullshit anyway. But she talked about that. But I looked over, and I see Nick get up. He was sitting right across from me, Nick Stonecipher from Spotlight. And I said, he leaves his stuff, and he goes to step out. And I'm like, he's going to talk to the woman who spoke up. I was like, let's see if he comes back. Maybe went to the men's. Doesn't come back. So it's going into pub. It's going to go into public comment. I got to go catch the bus to get back here because it was like 4 in the afternoon. I knew people were going to stand up. Steve Metro, our friend from the University of Delaware, just was asked to spout some facts. So he did that thing. Fair enough. Shout out Steve Metro. But so I got up and walked out. And sure enough, yeah, Nick was there with another activist friend of ours, comrade and friend, and the woman who spoke up. They were having a pretty pleasant conversation, as far as, I mean, considering. So yeah, I was happy to see Nick step out on the other side of it. I know that Spotlight is actually very keen to pick apart this ordinance, what this ordinance is, why, what's happening. That's sort of the angle that some over there seem like they want to take. His name could rhyme with Snarl Snaker. Yeah, I talked to Carl Baker today, and that's the kind of the angle they want to take. So at least, again, once again, there'll be some intrepid reporters picking in on this, you know, and seeing what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, so some activists stood up and tried to make demands. I had just walked out, but when I walked out, there was security at the door. I had to walk past somebody. Mm. And so when I saw Nick and the activist and the woman, I knew they weren't getting back in. I knew Nick was, but the other two were not.
Yep.
And that's what happened. So they weren't allowed back in to finish up, you know, what some of them were going to demand. And the demands were, I'm not going to read them all off, but it was so sort of, it was like, can you get 2 portable toilets there and clean them once a week? Can you, you know, it was like that kind of stuff. Really like the most minimum basic. Can you get larger trash bins so they can bin stuff and take it away more easily? You know, it was like that. And I'm just like, Jesus fucking Christ, this city stinks. But that was my day yesterday at the task force. And again, I will expect potentially by the time this comes out on Friday, there will be a Nick Stonecipher special in Spotlight, Delaware.
Yeah, I'll keep an eye out.
Yeah.
Make sure to link it.
All right. Last thing. Because Carl has decided, and I don't want to speak for you, but I kind of do because you want to speak just through the essays now. Because you said, like, I'm not going to respond to anything on Facebook anymore. If I get, like, more than, if I get a bunch of shit about one particular topic, I'm just going to write 5,000-word essay on it. Which I mean, we all in this group find that fantastic. So we all read it. I enjoyed it, but I knew that I was gonna, like, I don't know, I have my own. I'm one of the people always asking the party this, the party that.
Yeah.
So this was actually kind of towards me as well. Or I took it that way, but like in a good way.
Yeah. I mean, it's aimed at basically everybody I've worked with. Yeah, there's a, we could talk more about it, but.
Yeah, so it's called What Do We Mean When We Talk About the Party?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's
or what, the, we talk about when
what, we, what we talk about when we talk about the party. A little Raymond Carver reference. Yeah. Nice work.
And that's me being just like vaguely intellectual in the sense that I have that title in my head and have never actually read the book.
Did they do it as a stage play too?
I have no idea.
I don't know. I might be getting confused, but yeah, I mean, we talk about it in here. You know, the party this, the party that. But like you said, you had a combination of a kind of person in mind. Do you want to kind of explain what that question is or what the thesis is?
Yeah, so I think a lot of us, myself included, who got involved in politics during Trump 1, a lot of folks on the left especially got involved specifically because of Bernie Sanders. And there is sort of a narrative that was a big part of that campaign and the aftermath of it, that the party fucked over Bernie Sanders, which I think in a broad sense is somewhat true. I mean, I think the fact that he got as far as he did, despite nobody knowing who he was at the start, was very impressive in and of itself. But
you're talking about in 2016.
In 2016,
okay,
and then again in 2020, obviously, and there you can
but
get
in 2020. I think he was possibly more clearly and obviously fucked by the party, though. I mean, the party,
well,
in this,
so
the party in this case
about.
Being the Obama, right? Again, yeah. So the I you know,
yeah,
that's
so
why
that
I
gets
asked.
Into the thing. So we have this narrative that's very popular in the left that like the Democratic Party sucks, which it does. But I think we often are like, I see people reference the Democratic Party as the DNC, and that always struck me as like, this doesn't seem totally correct. And then you also see that here in Delaware where people talk about the party when they mean like Mimi or Bethany Hall Long or somebody. And so I saw a lot of people, there were specifically one or two arguments that I saw on Facebook that was like, okay, people are talking past each other because they're saying the party. And when this person says the party, they mean these elected officials. When this person says the party, they mean like the Kent County Democratic Committee that has like a chair and a vice chair and stuff. And so I was like, okay, we're all clearly talking past each other. And I think a lot of people who aren't the real sickos like a Jordan Pusey or
it's so
Kobe.
Funny when you said that, like the first person I thought of, because you said, I was like, RD23, Jordan Pusey, that's the first thing I thought of. Yeah, it's like the real,
yeah.
The real
so for
sickos.
People who are not really in it, most people don't have any real idea how the party works. And I only have, I'll be honest, I don't have like a super, super in-depth, which I felt a little bit weird writing this. But I've been in leadership in my ward. Like, I've talked to a lot of people who do this stuff. I felt I know enough.
Let's be honest. They also kind of make it up as they go along.
Yeah, and it's not like,
this is
not that complicated.
No,
it's just very,
it's
very silly.
Correct. It's more like, well, this is how we do things. And it was written down, and we actually have it in the spiral notebook. And we take it out, and, you know, like.
Yeah. And so, basically, one of the big things in organizing when you're putting together a strategy and tactics is that you have to look for who are the decision makers, who actually has power, and target that effectively. And so, kind of the idea of this piece was to break down, if you're talking about the Democratic Party as a concept, what are the who are the different decision makers, who has different power, and who makes all those decisions. So you have the Democratic Party itself, which is like an actual organization that consists of like all these RD committees. That's like the super delegates that go to the national committee, all that stuff. Like, that is an organization that exists. Apart from presidential primaries and like how delegates get decided, so that was a big thing back in 2016, was like the super delegates. Apart from that, the party doesn't really do much. Like, they can't tell any elected official to do this or do that. They cannot control the outcome of elections. They don't really do that much other than like special elections. That's really their like main power here in Delaware.
You don't think, can I interject or do you want
yeah.
to finish? No, I would just mean like, I, And maybe this is just like you said, it's a conglomeration of different views and sort of things you were pointing at. But I would say that they do hold a lot. I mean, the whole concept in the legislature right now of anti-activists, anti-working families party, anti-left extremists, you know, all this stuff, anti-Palestinian protesters, that is an institutional apparatus that's doing that. I think it's the Democratic. It's the leadership of both houses.
I think it's the superstructure of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what the party itself can wield more power than just like the official running of the special election.
Yeah. But the people who are doing that is not Betsy Marin and Cassandra Marshall. Like,
right.
They might be participating in it in a certain sense, but that gets in like to the other decision makers, which is the elected officials, I think, being the one that often have the most power, especially if we're talking about Delaware, where it's a pretty small state. I also broke it down to obviously the voters are a huge thing, which is sometimes the voters just like my biggest critique of Bernie 2020, that election was that he never had a plan to get to 50% of voters. He only had a plan to get to 35. And the reason why the Obama stuff, and we can talk about that specifically, because I think it's a great example of like how weirdly things move. The reason that worked is because he was never at 50%. And if he'd been at 50%, it didn't matter how many people consolidated. Like, look at Trump.
But traditionally, correct. But traditionally, and I think that's why they moved so quickly to do what was done, which,
yeah.
Because Bernie, whatever you want to say about it, look, probably won the Iowa caucus and the Nevada thing, won in California, I think, and had all this momentum. Normally, what I have in my time seen as a presidential primary kind of run itself out. So maybe one or two people drop, but they don't drop out en masse if there's a large field. So if he could have gotten past, he wouldn't have had to do that. He wouldn't have had to consolidate his power till later.
Yeah.
That's why I think intervening when Obama got basically Pete and Klobuchar and all these people to kind of just drop at the same time, and got Clyburn to basically say, this guy, Bernie's racist.
Yeah.
Then that was it. But I don't think they had to do it then. Because if it would have allowed for a little more time, I think he potentially would have had the opportunity to do what you're talking about and consolidate it.
But yeah, but so you have the voters. And then, and that's this kind of the wiggly space that I put in the middle, which is like the influencers, which that could refer to Barack Obama. That could refer to the Pod Save America guys. That could refer to fucking Hassan. Like, that could refer to basically anybody that has either influence over one of the other part of the party. So that could be influence over the elected officials, like Obama clearly does, influence over how voters think. So, like, any, like, big media figures obviously have a bit of control, and even some control over the party. And normally, people have influence over multiple. Like, most elected officials also consume the same media that their voters do. And so the point of this was to break down a little bit more specifically, if we say, oh, the party screwed over Bernie in 2020, that means we need to take over the DNC and make it progressive, or like break off from a third party and do this or that. We need to sort of get more specific about the fact that the reason why that happened, one, was because Bernie was not at 50% or was not able to consolidate. Like, everybody else was consolidated against him.
He
did not have enough
right
people
then.
Who could consult.
I mean, yeah.
Because sure. I go back to the Trump 2016 example, because Trump 2016, the Republicans wanted Trump or a Trump-like figure, because the same exact thing happened near the end of that. I think it happened a little bit later, which is part of why he was able to.
But I think, I wonder if you looked at the time, and I've never done this, yeah. But I remember there being a huge field and it getting whittled down.
It consolidated
as people,
fairly quickly.
Did it? See, because I just remember like a bunch of like sort of no names dropping out, and then maybe Herman Cain, and then there was like Chris. Then it was like, well, go with Christie, but then Christie dropped out. Go with Ted Cruz drops out.
Well,
go
so,
Rubio drops out, and so it's just like that. And maybe I'm wrong. If I looked at
so
it,
specifically,
it happened
what happened
quickly.
Near the end of the campaign was everybody right. else had dropped out except for Kasich and Cruz.
Yeah, Kasich. I
remember
that
John
guy.
Kasich. He loved eating.
Yes,
that was his big thing.
It was a Ohio guy, right?
Yep.
Ohio.
And so what was happening near the end, and I can go back and I can maybe link in the show notes, but basically they came to essentially an agreement, Kasich and Cruz, that like, we don't want Donald Trump to be the nominee. So like, we're going to kind of campaign together in that like, you really go for the states that you know you're going to do well in, and I'll go for the states that I'm going to do really well in, and we're going to like get enough delegates to keep Trump from being the nominee. And it just totally fell flat. Part of that was because they weren't that similar in terms of who they were. Like, Ted Cruz was the big, like, Bible Belt, like, Tea Party guy, and Kasich was, like, the respectable Rockefeller Republican moderate.
And this is the time where people didn't understand. There was no sort of understanding that people just wanted Trump.
Yeah, and Trump was just, like, the guy.
They thought that there was something they could do, like, some strategy they could do. And the strategy was, like, do what Trump's doing.
Yeah.
I guess that's what I'm trying to argue at the Democratic
Party. And then also,
Party.
There was no Republican Obama who could be, like, oh, we cannot have Trump. And so I'm going to step in. Like, who would that have been in 2016?
Yeah, I mean, nobody could do it.
Yeah, because that person now is Trump. Like,
yeah,
he's the only person who has.
Yeah, because he got up there, like, stepping all over, like, a George W. Bush or these people.
Like, yeah, like George W. Bush.
Like, Lynn Cheney, you know, was a Harris person. So, yeah, no, I mean, again, you're right about that.
And so, you know, if we're looking at that influence, then, like, we have to look at, okay, why did Obama wield the power that he did? And then that's the issue that we have to address, not like the party. So it's a very specific kind of point, and it is very granular for people who are specifically interested in getting involved in the Democratic Party ecosystem to make change to push it to the left. So it doesn't include people who are like, we need a third party, we need to do this, which I think is like, if you want to make that argument, I disagree with it in the way that I think a lot of people argue with it. I mean, obviously, I'm with the Working Families Party, so I have a very specific reason that I want to break off and form like different bases of power, but
I guess I come back because I'm one of them, and I guess I always come back to the idea like we're seeing, number one, we're seeing too many people flake out. I think we have a better handle on how to handle that part of it and kind of get absorbed into the system.
Yeah,
and that's what the party or the apparatus of the status quo in the state, the corporate sort of centrist status quo, the abundance people of Delaware.
Yeah. I'm trying to imagine like but Kerry Harris calling herself like an abundance Democrat. It's going to happen one day.
It's probably already happened, bro. Dude, I don't even want to think about that.
But
that
I think what I
mean is that as long as people like you can differentiate these things and understand that these dynamics are there, I guess that's fine. But the fact of the matter is that there are forces that are already delineating who's on which side. That's happening in the media and in Leg Hall now. Well, so I think, that's what I'm thinking about. How do we address that within the framework you're putting together? How would we address that?
That's
if they're
a good
already
example.
Pushing you out, or at least making you persona non grata.
So I think to use that example of legislators have a lot of pressure on them to like discharge from WFP and to like go along to get along. The argument that I'm making is I do think that is a operation of the Democratic Party in the colloquial sense. Definitely. I mean, that's, I think, fairly inarguable. But if I were to try to fix that problem by saying, oh, and that's why we need a new state party chair, that's not going to solve anything. Like, I get why people are working on it. I'm not going to dissing people for working on that particular project. But if you're working on that to be like, oh, we need to, like, make it so that people are going to be nicer to WFP, just using, like, a selfish example, that's not going to work.
Or any example. The idea that that's correct.
But
I think
if we...
That argument's... Because if you think that any outcome there is going to change any of the dynamics at Leg Hall, I can tell you it's not.
Yeah.
Now, it might indirectly...
In the sense that there's like a larger wave of people who don't want that to happen.
Right.
And it's like bleeding over in other areas.
Correlation.
But fundamentally, the only way you can change that if it's a structure that is being used by caucus leadership of the Democratic Party, the only way to change that is to change the caucus leadership of the Democratic Party, which means you have to go to the voters and kick those people out. And so that's a very different type of organizing than trying to elect people to RD committees and then change the party chair. And it's even different than like having the influencers to a certain extent. I mean, actually, in Delaware, we are technically Democratic influencers.
Ultimately, I mean, I'm probably the biggest leftist influencer in the state. I can't imagine. Is there anybody doing the shit I'm doing? I don't believe so. Again, 350 fucking eps.
Yeah.
Come on. What's Spadola do? 12?
Pathetic.
Mic'd up, Have they gotten to 100?
Oh, no way.
So, look, and I know the guy downstate. He's not a leftist, but there's the guy that does...
Buccioni.
Love that guy. But no, I don't want to get off on a tangent. Yes, we are sort of influencers in a certain sense, but I'm for that. I agree with that. I agree that, like, focusing on the apparatus of the party, I've made this point so many times, made it to Jordan Pusey and everybody else. Focusing on the apparatus of the party, your RD, who the party chair is going to be, whether Kobe's going to be the vice chair. No shade to Kobe. I know, look, we're just saying in our conversation, that's not going to change shit. That's not going to change the way that Mimi and leadership and Kim Williams talk about to the press what people that people we organize with want to do, what progressives want to do, what the Working Families Party wants to do, what leftists like me want to do. Yeah, that part I completely agree with. And the way to deal with that is the way you said to deal with it.
Yeah, so to get rid of people in office, for one. And then also, I do think I have often in my life underestimated this, but like having more people who are intentional about changing the narrative. And I try to think about ways to do that isn't just like posting.
Yeah.
Because that is kind of something, but like a lot of people do that and it's not really that useful.
No, it's not useful at all.
But like, you know, what we're doing here is technically an attempt to influence.
I was just going
to
say the same thing.
When I write a call piece, like obviously there's a part of me that is attempting to influence the way that people think about this or that.
Of course. Well, this is the argument I always make with journalists anyway. When you pick the story you want to do to tell the facts you want to tell, you're making a decision to tell people that for a reason.
Yeah.
So, yeah, of course.
And so, yeah, ultimately it is. And so this is obviously also a very targeted sort of piece because, one, I think it really only applies in Delaware in terms of the way that I framed it, because there's very few other places where you kind of find yourself in such, because as a actual public messaging thing, differentiating the party and not the party doesn't matter at all. If you go to the average person and say like, hey, does the Democratic Party suck? They'll say like, yeah. They might be talking about Hakeem Jeffries. They might be talking about whoever the new guy is, the new chair of the DNC, whatever. Ben Wickler? No.
Jamie
Harrison was the last guy.
Oh, yeah, that guy's
the guy from Ken Martin.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, that doesn't really matter. Like, for an average voter, that doesn't matter. But yeah. In a situation in Delaware where if you get involved in politics, you immediately get sucked into this ecosystem of a very tight-knit group of people for the most part.
And it's only like this. It's very homogenous.
It's very homogenous. And this is kind of, for me, the way I was thinking about it, is kind of a field guide for if you're like a lefty activist who wants to make change and you have to interact with a lot of people who maybe don't share your views but are somewhat sympathetic, here's how to talk about this in a way that won't get you in trouble.
Yeah, I never think along those terms.
Because it's both like an organizing piece of just like, let's be specific about who we talk about. But then it's also like when we're dealing with like conversations with people who we might need to win over, here's how to make sure you're not making an ass of yourself, basically. And like talking about things that don't actually match up.
Yeah, kind of understand the dynamics.
Yeah.
Strategize or at least think about it in the right way. I can dig it. I knew I was going to dig it. We sort of mentioned it before it went out. Because I guess Bill, more people helped with the editing. I think I fixed two like punctuation mistakes just because I just wanted to be like, I looked at it. Yeah, I have some views. it was very good. Because it's like it was a way to easily explain some of the little wrinkles that we talk about. Like, you know, I'll say don't fuck with your RD. What I mean is,
doesn't mean don't do politics.
Don't do politics. It means you have to understand like what benefit is our movement getting from that? Our project. I call it the project. What benefit is our project getting from it? Nothing really. Like you get to say you're the thing and you beat the other guy and you know, you can tell them if it made a quorum, I guess, or whatever. But ultimately, at the end of the day, that's a zero. That's not what we're talking about. We did it. We did another hit show.
Every week?
Every fucking week. Here's how we'll finish it. So, this is a little bit of bunker lore. The way that the studio got set up originally was I had this idea to do it, and I got put in touch with Carl because he could help produce it. He kind of knew how to do it, and I met a guy who was a friend of my brother who lived on my block at that time in an apartment over a shop. But if you go in there, he had a full sound studio in there where he produced music. He was also a band leader, so on the weekends he would take live bands all up and down the East Coast. So if you wanted like a 12-piece band at your wedding or you wanted a 3-piece band at your event or whatever, he did that. Tino. Well, over the years, he's moved away, but we've always talked and followed, and he was actually very helpful for the first few, like working the equipment or telling me what to do, whatever. Have you met him? Did you ever meet him?
I don't think so. Or I don't remember.
Okay.
I wouldn't remember. So.
Yeah, okay. So he hits me up this week, and he goes, you're still doing it, right? I was like, yeah, of course, man. We just remodeled the studio. I said, we're killing it. 350 eps. I said, my partner, Carl, he just produced like music out of here for his like 12 episode series on the Knights of Labor. He was like, bro, that's awesome. He's extremely supportive. Always has been. And he said, he's living in Austin. Hmm. He's had a kid.
He has a new wife.
I should have asked him about his housing. Yeah. I did think about it when he mentioned it. But one of the things he's doing is setting up people to do audio. Podcasts, or he said, a lot of mental health people want to do like their tip for the day. He's like, he's helping a lot of authors do audiobooks. Hmm. But now he's like, and setting up people in little home studios. So he said, I've always wanted to do this, but I'm going to try to like actually do it like as a business.
He's like,
Would you write a review of the business since it's like this? I'm like consulting basically for audio, audio consulting and home audio production. He'll do your production. He'll set you up with a nice mic and stuff and show you how to send a file. He'll produce it, all that stuff. So I wrote him this big thing. I was like, Tino this and Tino that. He's like, this is great, dude. He's like, but he's going by Constantine now with a K. Mm,
yeah.
He was like, so underneath of it on his website now, it says, Rob, thanks. We've been friends a long time. He's like, by the way, Rob talks about Tino. That's me. Same guy. But yeah, so we got some accolades from him. Without him, we would not know much. He was the one who helped me pick out the stuff for the mobile kit that we just started, 6 months ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, real good dude. But yeah, so we still have a connection with our past, and we're walking into the future.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing we can do.
Thank you, Constantine.
Left is best.